I think it's like the mentality is this is what it means to succeed, is to check all the boxes, color within the lines, all that stuff. And it's really just incredible cowardice, the success roadmap and many other things. Much more credentialistic, much more bureaucratic, a lot of things like that. The only people who actually do go against the grain, by and large, they're sort of whack. They're provocateurs. They've said the other mechanism by which you become famous and make a living, if you don't want to check all these boxes and go through the tedious resume building process, is to become like an online influencer. And you do that by becoming a provocateur. And so essentially, we've almost created a culture where to go against the grain, to display courage, I think for a lot of people is coded as act like a jerk.
Hey folks, welcome back to the Throwing Mountains podcast, where men are rediscovering courageous leadership. Hey, join us, pull up a chair. You're going to be strengthened by the stories of God working in the lives of ordinary men today. These men who've become leaders in their spheres of influence by relying on God and following Jesus. Welcome. My name is Mike Hatch. I am your host, and I am joined, as usual, with best-selling author Chris Bullinger. If you are new to listening to us, we're very grateful that you chose to invest your most valuable resource, your time, into listening to our podcast, and I believe that it will pay off incredibly in spades. So welcome to our show. We're grateful to have you. I just want to take a moment to thank our amazing partner, biblicalleadership.com. We are part of their podcast network and very grateful for the work that they're doing. Their vision really is to lift up Christ, to spread his word and edify, encourage, and spark boldness in his servants around the world. They want to see the Bible become a practical leadership manual that sits open on the desks of thousands of leaders. Because that's what the Bible is, a real-world guide to living. It is first a guide to eternal life, but it also speaks to the important areas of life here and now, including marriage, parenting, faith, work, and of course, leadership. So make sure you check out biblicalleadership.com. Now, I want to welcome our guest today. Really excited to have Aaron Wren with us. Aaron is a writer, a consultant in Indianapolis. He is a co-founder and senior fellow at American Reformer. And he had his first career in management and technology consulting, where he advised major corporations as a partner at Accenture. And then he had a second career in urban policy as a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research. Today, his focus is on helping conservatives in the American church rise to the challenge of finding success in the 21st century. So we're really excited to welcome Aaron Wren to the Throwing Mountains podcast. Aaron, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
We want to start out with you, as we do with all of our guests, and for those who are maybe joining us for the first time, or those who might need a reminder, we start out every interview with a fence post story. And fence post stories are basically just imagine a fence that sits along a property, and every vertical post that's solidly in the ground represents significant moments or people in our lives that make us who we are today. And of course, this comes from CLC, our other ministry partner, where all of the content, all the curriculum used for that discipleship program starts with fence post stories, with men sitting around telling their stories, maybe for the first time ever. So Aaron, we'd love to learn more about you and your background. And if you wouldn't mind, share a few fence posts. Give us an idea of the journey that God has brought you on to this point.
Sure. Well, I grew up in rural southern Indiana, about 4 miles outside of a town that had fewer than 100 people in it. And
oh, wow.
It was rural, but not remote. You could drive to Louisville, Kentucky in 45 minutes. It wasn't a farming community. Most people worked in factories. But I grew up there. I was actually from Catholic peasant stock on both sides of my family. But my mother got involved in the Catholic Charismatic Renewal Movement in the 70s, ended up leaving the Catholic Church and became a Pentecostal, brought me along with her. So I was baptized Catholic, but actually raised in a Assemblies of God church, again, in a rural area during the 70s and 80s, very end timesy, you might say. Definitely not prosperity gospel by any way,
okay,
but certainly
good.
That church is still there and doing well and doing great work.
I was going to say real quick, Aaron, just to interrupt you, we actually have the Ark and the Dove. It's like a Catholic retreat center right down the street from my house where they claim that's where that whole charismatic movement in the Catholic Church was ignited, by the way. So interesting you say that. That hits close to home.
Yeah. So I went off to college at Indiana University and wasn't really living as a Christian, to be honest, most of my adult life. But I was a finance major by default and realized by the end of my college career that if I spent the rest of my life as a loan officer in a bank, I'd probably blow my brains out. And in the meantime, I'd gotten very into computers. I'd always liked computers since I had my Commodore 64 back in junior high, and I could program, but I really got into programming in college. And I would spend like all my free time programming computers and doing things on computers. And I loved it. I was passionate about computers. What I really want to do is computers. And so I needed a job. And it was 1992, graduating from college. And the internet is there, but there's no World Wide Web. Okay, so keep that in mind. You can't Google for information. But I saw that there was an opening for a LAN administrator, a network administrator at Indiana University. It was going to pay $8 an hour. And of course, that was better pay. Minimum wage then was $3.35 an hour, which I'd made that, but still wasn't a great job as a computer technician. And I'm like, I'm going to apply for that job because I want to work in computers. In the meantime, I was going through the interview process with different companies. There were two companies basically everybody wanted to work for at coming out of IU's business school. One was Procter & Gamble as a brand manager. I didn't want to do that. I wasn't a marketing guy. Second was to work for this consulting company called Anderson Consulting,
Anderson,
now known as Accenture.
Right.
And again, there's no internet, something consulting. What is that? So I go to the placement office and they've got all their literature there. And it says things like, we help our clients change to be more successful. Like, what does that mean? So I go to my interview and the guy walks in. He's Aaron Wren. Are you on the radio? And I said, no, but I actually work at the campus radio station. We had a little classical NPR station. I'm an audio engineer, and they occasionally say my name in the credits. And so we basically spent 30 minutes of our interview talking about classical music. He's like, great. And somebody will be in touch about scheduling an office interview. So then I get invited to this office interview in Chicago, and I go up there, and partner's there. He's pounding the table. He's going, this is the best effing consulting company on the effing planet. You'd be an idiot to work anywhere else but here. The whole interview was stuff like that. They never actually asked me any questions. So I go to lunch. Second interview is these two guys, meet the troops, people who are more junior levels. And so they took me to lunch, but these are two guys who'd gone to college together. They hadn't really seen each other in a long time. So they spent the whole lunch catching up. And then in the afternoon, it's like, oh, do you have any questions for us? I'm like, well, I can't ask, what does this company actually do?
And yeah, right.
Because I can't ask that question. So I went back and I said, look, I really want to work in computers. That's what I want to do. And in fact, I was praying over this land administrator job. Probably to this day, I'd never prayed to get some specific thing more than that in my entire life. And I said, I have no idea what this Anderson company even does. So they sent me an offer to move to Chicago and work for them, but I have it, and I'm not hearing back on the land administrator job. So I finally emailed the guys at the land administrator job. Where do I stand in the process? No, we're not going to hire you. So they turned me down, and I go to work in Chicago, and I show up at Anderson Consulting, and what do I know? They do nothing but install computer systems for large corporations. That's what the company does.
Wow.
And I spent basically 15 years there doing technology work at Anderson Consulting in Chicago on a radically different and better career track than I ever would have had. I would have turned that job down to take this land administrator job if I'd gotten it. Because I'm like, I don't know what these guys do. Sounds kind of bogus. The days when you could not know what a company actually did and you couldn't just Google it. And of course, they're not a consumer brand. So it's not like Procter & Gamble. I know what they do. They make soap. Whereas, what is a consulting company? And it's right. Still very vague. In fact, people used to say when I was there, the hardest part of your job is explaining to your parents what it is you actually do all day. That would be a major fence post. And that was kind of a long story, so we'll stop it there. Getting that job in Chicago versus the job that I actually wanted and had been praying to get sent me on a completely different trajectory and most likely a vastly better trajectory than I ever would have had.
Your experience, Aaron, reminds me of I graduated from Akron a couple years before you graduated from Indiana, and most of my business school friends had similar experiences with what was then the Big Eight. And I kept asking them, what do these companies do? They all had these titles like program analyst. What do you analyze? What is a program analyst? And they couldn't explain it to me. But they all got good jobs and they were paid well, so I guess it worked out. But it's interesting to hear about
Anderson.
Yes,
yes, yes, yes. We were one of the Big Eight firms. And we were the best and the biggest in technology. And then fortunately for us, we split off. It was originally the consulting division of Arthur Andersen, the accounting firm. And we split off from them. And as part of that split off, we had to rename ourselves Accenture. And then when Andersen went out of business in the wake of the Enron scandal, that as well turned out to be providential. Yeah. We'd been in some arbitration with them. And the only thing that we quote unquote lost was having to give up the Andersen name. And that turned out to be like a win too. So you never know when something that seems like a gigantic L in the long term turns out to be a huge win.
Right.
Interesting. Man, you have such an interesting spiritual background with growing up Catholic and then getting, you know.
I mean, I really wasn't. I didn't say growing up Catholic. We left the Catholic Church when I was like five. I remember nothing at all about. I have no memories of being Catholic. I know I was baptized as a Catholic.
Okay.
But that was it.
So where are you now? What type of church do you attend? And by the way, I do appreciate, too, it tells me a lot about your doctrine, that you would distinguish the type of charismatic church experience you had from the prosperity gospel. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Because that is destructive doctrine. So, yeah, where are you now?
Yeah, I attend a Presbyterian church.
Yes.
So to fast forward there, late in my career at Accenture, gotten very interested in cities and urban policy. It's been said that I love cities like only somebody from a town of 29 people can. And I got very interested in cities, reconnected with faith, was attending this actually non-denominational Baptistic church in Chicago, very moody Bible Institute influence.
Yep, familiar.
And I mentioned to the pastor that I was all into cities. And he's like, oh, do you ever heard of Tim Keller? And I'm like, no, I've never heard of him. And he's like, well, you should check out Tim Keller. And he sent me a whole bunch of stuff about Tim Keller. And I'm like, oh, this Tim Keller guy makes a lot of sense. And the way he talked about cities, I'm like, this guy actually understands what he's talking about cities. So I got very interested in his theology. And I start hearing, oh, you should meet with this church planning guy in Chicago. He's doing work with Keller's church planning stuff in Chicago. It's sort of affiliated with him. So I'm like, okay, I have lunch with him. He's like, yeah, we're planning these churches. They're gospel-centered, reformed theology, all this stuff. And then I get home and I'm like, what's Reformed theology? So I better start looking that up. I'm like, oh, that's what that is. That sounds interesting. And that's my entry point into it. Although obviously as an urban professional type, some type of Presbyterian type church is probably more aligned with social class. Protestantism is still very, very stratified by social class and other backgrounds. So that was probably a big factor as well. And obviously as an intellectual type person, the Presbyterian was very doctrinal in its development, certainly an appeal. I think it's interesting to compare Presbyterianism with the Pentecostal church I grew up in. I still greatly appreciate that. I go back to that church, and the truth is they're doing the great work. Like the chaplain of the county jail attends there. They've got halfway houses. They're dealing with lots of people with drug problems. I'd say a third of that congregation are people who are coming out of very serious life problems, ex-offenders, drug addictions, people who've been victims of abuse, lots of things of that nature. And the truth is, Presbyterian churches don't really have a lot to offer those people for the most part. They do a lot of great work in the sense of writing checks to ministries or maybe running them. They run a ministry, but it's a little bit disconnected from the life of the church. Those people that are being served through those ministries are more or less typically not attending on Sunday morning. And so I think it's good to have intellectual people. It's good to have people who are dealing with people who have very serious problems. My brother's got this quip, when you have extreme problems, sometimes you need extreme religion. And that's kind of a good. His other one is rich people go to therapy, poor people go to church. And that's sort of there's something to that as well. I sort of look at these denominations as not necessarily per se a good thing, but there is an essence in which they've all got their own kind of unique spiritual gift, if you will, is there a certain kind of thing. Baptists are really great at preaching the Great Commission and doing that. And the Pentecostals do a lot of great work with people who got very serious life troubles. And so there's different people who have different gifts. So I try to appreciate them all. I'm not Catholic, but I appreciate a lot of what the Catholic Church does as well. And so I try not to get too wrapped up in like the one true denomination.
Aaron, what brought you back to Indiana? You were in Chicago for 17 years so?
Yeah, I was in Chicago probably close to 20 years. And then I ended up, as I was transitioning into cities, it's again a long story we shouldn't cover here because I could never even begin to make sense of it myself. But I ended up in New York City as a senior fellow at a think tank called the Manhattan Institute in New York, basically sort of a conservative think tank there. They were really the intellectual engine of the Giuliani administration in a lot of ways when you helped clean up New York. And so they've long had a very urban focus, very different from a lot of the DC think tanks. So I spent a lot of time there. And then we moved back to Indianapolis at the very end of 2019, which is very providential. When you think about the pandemic starting in 2020, New York really getting hit, got married, had a young kid. People used to ask me when we had a kid in New York, are you going to stay in New York? Are you going to leave? I said, I have no plans to leave, but I look around my neighborhood and it's full of kids, but 93% of them are five and under. So odds are I'm going to turn into a statistic. Sure enough, that's what's happened. And then I'd also made a second pivot in a career. I like to say I have three careers. I had my consulting career. I had my sort of urban career, and I still do a little bit of both of those. And then I sort of pivoted into a little bit men's issues in the future of the evangelical church. A decade ago, I saw that young men were turning to online influencers and turning away from the church. And I had also come to the conclusion that the church itself, some of its teachings on men were frankly wrong. I think a lot of the evangelical approach to gender is simply flawed in material ways. And I saw that these online guys had tapped into some things that, even though many of them were like the opposite of Christian morality, they had gotten some sort of factual things directionally correct. And like, wow, all these men are going to these guys. They're not coming to church. Everybody knows the church is not going to have men and all that. Maybe I should engage on this problem and try to bring a new set of ideas around gender to the church, especially around men's issues. And I was really trying to decide what I wanted to do at the time. I was living in New York working for a nonprofit. I'm like, I need to develop some additional sources of income. So my original plan was I'm going to start a website devoted to the microbiome, intestinal bacteria, gut health. Of course, now tons of people are talking about that. It wasn't as big. A lot of the stuff I was doing back then is now huge. I'm like, I could have created the best website on this and made a bunch of money. Maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it would have been a flop. But that's what I was thinking. Yeah. It was purely going to be a profit-making venture. I said, know what I'm going to do instead? I said, here's what I'll do. I didn't see anybody else talking about these issues anywhere in the church. None. And so I said, well, I feel obligated to step up and say something. So I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a newsletter. It was originally called The Masculinist, about men's issues in the church. And I have like 35 people who are my friends and associates that I've asked to be part of this newsletter. And they said yes. And if it grows to 500 people by word of mouth at the end of the first year, I will continue it. If not, I will shut it down. So I was getting close to the end of year one. I had something like 268 people on it. If I'd had 497, I probably would have justified doing it. Look, it didn't hit it. And I think I've used this method for other things. There's this thing scientists do now where they pre-register their expected results of their experiments. So the idea is you're doing this experiment in psychology, and then you sort of massage the data to come up with some publishable paper, regardless of whether you got the results you were testing or not. So the idea is pre-registration is like, I'm going to put a stake in the ground about what I'm expecting. And that way, if I don't get it, maybe I can still publish a paper, but I at least have to say that the results were contrary to that. It's sort of to get away from some of this massaging and p-hacking and other things that they do. Well, I've got this technique that I'd use it similar, which is to say, preset a gate as to whether you will continue something or not. So if you go into a new endeavor, it's very easy to come up with the sunk cost fallacy where you're like, wow, right. I'm so far into this. You keep throwing good money out of bed. And so it's very hard to know when or if to stop. And I said, I'm going to set an objective measure in an objective period of time that if I don't hit these, I'm out. This is what success looks like. I'm predefining success. I think that's a useful technique. You can't use it for everything, but I felt like when I went to cities, it was much more difficult to pivot from consulting to cities than I anticipated. And I had overinvested massively in it. It could have turned out to be a complete failure for me. And I'm like, I'm never doing that again. I'm never going to just start going into something like that without some clear criteria about what success looks like such that I'll continue investing. So I set this gate of 500. I only had 268. So I'm like, I'm going to be disciplined. I'm shutting it down. And so what I did was, I said, I'm never going to get to 500. I've got two more months. So forget the men's issues. I'm just going to put my absolute two best ideas ever about the church out there. One of them was this three worlds model analyzing the relationship of culture and Christianity since 1960s and analyzing what's going on in the evangelical world. And it was called The Lost Worlds of Evangelicalism. I think it was newsletter number 13. And I said, I'll write something about Nassim Taleb, his idea of black swans and all that. That's very interesting. I'm very influenced by that way of thinking. And so I wrote those, and then I sent an email to all of my charter subscribers, and I said, thank you that you agreed to be part of this. I've decided to close the newsletter down. Here's why, blah, 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 blah. And literally the only thing left was I was going to send out like one final blast to the list and say, this is the last newsletter. Thank you, everybody. And then one day, we're living in New York, we were walking to get ice cream with our son, and we walk from home to the ice cream shop, and I'm in line to buy ice cream, and I pick up my phone, I've got 25 emails, and they're all subscriptions to my newsletter. I'm like, what's going on? So I delete all those, and then we sit down to eat the ice cream. I pick up my phone again, I got 15 more just while we're eating the ice cream. I'm like, what's going on here? So I delete all those. Somebody must have mentioned me, so I Google it. And it finds out somebody had taken that three worlds model and sent it to Rod Dreher, who wrote this piece. He's like, you got to read this thing. This is amazing. And it sent me like 2,500 subscribers in a week. thanks to that. And wow. So I guess my newsletter keeps going. And I think that this story and the other one about joining Accenture show that we think that we're the masters of our fate. We think these things are happening. In fact, there are some things that we know we're making a momentous decision. When we get married, we know we're making a momentous decision. There are a lot of decisions and a lot of things that happen that we don't understand the significance of them at the time. Yes. Or there are things that just happen that we weren't expecting. This is why I say the black swan. It came right up about the black swan. I'm like, that was a black swan event, if you will. Mm-hmm. This random event, I had not sent that piece to Rod Dreher. Somebody else sent it to Rod Dreher. And that event triggered him to write about it. I wasn't expecting that. I didn't even know he'd seen it. And yet it sent me 10 times as many subscribers as I'd have. And so those little moments like that are so influential. That's one of the things Taleb says. These outliers are massively influential in our lives, in societies, et cetera. And a lot of times we don't think like that. And we have a very narrow and small vision of what God can be because everything is about inside the box of what we can see. And my newsletter this month is actually going to talk about what I call the pragmatic mindset. The pragmatic mindset says, here's what I can do with my own two hands, with what's in front of me to make this happen. And there's a sense in which we have to operate in that mode, but that leads to sort of constrained thinking. And the truth is, the world's a much bigger place than we think. Yeah. And God can intervene and things can happen that we don't even know. And so we foreclose possibilities. I don't think that's a recipe for stupidity, but Elon Musk wants to go settle Mars. He's like, I want to colonize Mars. How are we going to colonize Mars? I have no idea. Well, we got to have a rocket to get there. So let's work on the rocket first. And so he reinvents the rocketry business. And he's like, I need some money to pay for this rocket. What am I going to do? Hey, maybe I should build this satellite internet system as a way to make money. He created this revolutionary new low-latency satellite internet system called Starlink that's now revolutionizing satellite communications.
Yep.
And the only reason he did it was to make money for his plan to colonize Mars. So I don't think you have to do stupid. Yeah. Again, Silicon Valley's got this can-we-make-it-happen mindset. And again, I don't think stupidity is this idea of setting a gate, setting some criteria. I think that's legitimate to do. I did that. I prayed over that. I said, okay, God, I'll engage in this area. And if you want me to be successful in that area, I will be successful. Nothing will stop that. Man. If you don't, there's nothing that's going to happen. So I'll say, maybe you want me to do this, maybe you don't. I'll try it. And start trying to make some money. I'll try this newsletter for a year. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be diligent. I'm going to do all the business that I'm supposed to be taking care of, but then ultimately what will happen? And so I'd already essentially shut it down. I told people I was shutting it down, and then boom, this happened. And then First Things Magazine asked me to update that piece. I originally wrote the Three Worlds piece in 2017. It was published in 2022, February 22 edition of First Things Magazine, in an article called The Three Worlds of Evangelicalism, which is probably the most talked about article in the history of First Things Magazine. It was certainly the most read article of that year. And now, opportunity to promote myself, I actually turned it into a book called Life in the Negative World, Confronting the Challenges of Anti-Christian Culture. It comes out from Zondervan on January 30th. So Life in the Negative World, you want to buy that one. But it was another thing, that the fact that I stepped out of this newsletter And then things happened that I had no anticipation about. I didn't know First Things wanted to adapt it, too. I just got an email out of the blue. Do you want to do this? And it set off an entire chain reaction of things that took me in directions that I could never have anticipated. And so I think we need to also keep our minds open to the possibilities out there in the world that we often miss.
Okay, Aaron, I've got a key question for you. So you're writing a newsletter called The Masculinist, and it's all about issues related to, I think, primarily young men, how the church is missing young men, how young men are going after online influencers. You decide to shut it down. And as a last gasp, I guess, you write an article or a piece on evangelicalism, which really isn't directly related to masculinity, right? It's kind of a general purpose.
I tried to shoehorn it in.
Okay.
It was kind of a...
But would you... Do you think you would have written the piece if you weren't shutting down The Masculinist? Would it have fit in The Masculinist, or was it just a, I'm shutting this down anyway, let me just write something I'm passionate about and put it in there in the last issue?
To be honest, I've never been a focused writer. Most of the advice on writing and acquiring audiences online and all that is you got to be focused on a particular market, a particular niche, particular customer. Here's what I'm doing. Even my urban work, you should be focused on one big theme, one big idea, and hammering that and explaining that. And I was never able to do that. For one thing, I'm not one of these people that has one idea that revolutionizes the world. The three worlds thing is the closest thing to it. It has become a big deal. And I got to remind myself to constantly be talking about that. Because that's what it is. I feel like, okay, I wrote that once. I can't write it again. Actually, you got to keep saying the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. You start watching different lectures that these famous pastors give. You realize they're giving the same basic lecture over and over and over and over and over and over again. Which you need to. It's not bad. So this idea of being ultra-focused on men's issues is one that I don't know that I can really ever ultra-focus on that. I try to be more focused. I'm trying to dial back other things and really focus on where I have the wins above replacement, if you will. Mm-hmm. And that is an area, I think, because I think the evangelical church is still very off base on that. At the same time, one of the things that makes it challenging for me to do that is I'm unwilling to be a guru and give all this life advice to people. Mm-hmm. So again, part of that is the influence of Taleb. Part of it is the influence of my own life experience. These stories I tell you, the outcomes of my life have not been shaped by my masculinity building program for myself.
Right.
There is some of that, but it's not like, let me tell you how to get rich in business. Let me tell you how to build this huge audience.
Right.
Here's what you need to be doing in your life. And it's like, if you take a guy like Andrew Tate, probably a lot of your readers have heard of Andrew Tate. Andrew Tate's telling you, you need to do this, 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 you need to, they're all giving advice.
Yeah.
Well, first off, you don't know anything about these people. They may not be living it themselves. That may not at all be the source of what happened to them. I happen to have a little bit of background info on some of these people. And I'm like, your money came from completely different sources than you're portraying that it came from. Secondly, a lot of these people just flat out got lucky. Not to say that they didn't do anything wrong, but this idea that I'm going to be your guru and I'm going to tell you how to get rich, I'm going to tell you how to have success in life, that's basically like the motivational speaker shtick, the whole Tony Robbins thing, waking the giant with all that stuff. That's how you make money, and that's how you grab audience by flattering them. I don't want to do that. I don't want to give advice. For one thing, I got some advice in life. It was actually good advice, and it turned out disastrously for me when I followed it. And so I realized telling other people, this is, again, one of Taleb's things, is about skin in the game. You know, if I tell you, well, you guys just need, if you want to make your podcast bigger, you should do X, Y, Z, or you should do this, that, the other thing. I don't have any skin in the game. That's why I don't like to tell people what to do. I try to give people ideas. Here's ideas you can consider. You can try this, like the gating idea. I'm not telling you you have to do that. That's a tool. You have to make the decision whether or not you do that. Because it's going to be on you. The results are going to be on you. It's not going to be on me. I tell you that. I put that forward as a tool because it's one I personally used. So I actually do have skin in the game for that particular tool because it's one I used. I don't like to say, here's what I did. Don't give people stock tips. Show them what's in your portfolio. That's the difference. I'm not in charge. The world is weirder than we think. And so that is one thing about if you really want to be, quote unquote, the men's guru, you got to give them the sell about how they can be the Ubermensch if they follow your program. Mm. you got to have the right mindset, and you got to be working out every day, and you got to be hustling on your business and your side. It's all this stuff. And it's not all bad. It's good. I've actually applied some of that stuff and it works. But at the end of the day, that's not the kind of person I am. I don't feel comfortable giving directive advice to other people I don't know. I take very seriously that, like, people act on the things that I say. And those actions can have profound consequences for their lives and their churches. Sometimes I get emails from people. Here's a video of the sermon where the preacher's quoting you. I get emails from people. Somebody will be like, Aaron, you said this and it literally changed my life. And I'm like, wow, that's nice. But there's a weight of responsibility that comes with that.
Yeah.
If I have no audience and nobody's doing anything that I say, then I can just run my mouth. But the more influential you become, the more high of an audience to come, the more you need to feel the weight of responsibility that comes with that. Because if people are doing what I'm telling them to, so I try to avoid telling people that, but if people are like really structuring their entire ministries about the ideas in my book, I better be really, really, really serious and diligent about what I'm saying. And so I don't like to throw out half-cocked advice, because if you do that, you can really steer people wrong. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things that has been a tremendous advantage for me versus pastors. I think one of the problems evangelicalism has is that it relies on pastors to be the all-purpose guides to life. Whereas in the Catholic Church, there are a lot of just essentially lay intellectuals. So you take a guy like Patrick Deneen, wrote a book called Why Liberalism Failed. The guy talking about politics and political theory is not a priest. He's not a Catholic theologian. He's a college professor who's Catholic and centers his Catholic identity. Whereas I think in the evangelical church world, in the Protestant church world, there's way more dependence on pastors to be all-purpose gurus to life. Yeah. And they're not. And the thing is, if they get out of their lane, which is Bible teaching and theology and pastoring and that, and I do think there's an element of them to say that to the people who are under their care. Just as giving advice to my son, I will do that. Why? Because I have skin in the game. Whatever happens to him, I'm in it for the rest of my life with that guy. It's very different to giving advice to you. But the point is, you start getting out of your lane and you imbue life coaching with the patina of scriptural authority. And if anything goes wrong, then you end up really hurting people and discrediting gospel. That's what happened with I Kiss Dating Goodbye and purity culture. If you read I Kiss Dating Goodbye, now that guy, he became a pastor later, but he wasn't a pastor, but it was promoted by a lot of pastors. And I read the book before he unpublished it. And I Kiss Dating Goodbye is basically a vast amount of advice, extra biblical advice about dating that people interpreted as what it means to be a Christian, is to live like this. No, that's just one guy's system. Maybe it'll work for you, maybe it won't. And so the advantage I have, and I'm always very clear, I'm not a Bible teacher. You know, I'm not a theologian. I'm not an authoritative person. You listen to me talk. I'm not talking about, yo, Romans 3:72 says this or whatever. I'm saying I'm analyzing it in a sort of lay method, hopefully with sort of Christian values. And so that gives me a huge advantage, I think, in some of these areas over the pastors who really, if you give people advice and it goes wrong for them, now they feel like they've been spiritually abused. Now they feel like Christianity is a fake religion. That's where they get a little sideways on it. But I even think about that as a layperson, that the things that I say, you got to take them seriously. And again, especially the higher
you yourself, know, and, you're saying. You need to take them seriously yourself.
And I think, and a lot of people like to get on the case of some of these big name pastors. You know, take Tim Keller. He got a lot of criticism late in his life from people who thought maybe, I'm going to paraphrase, I think a lot of them think he talked like a politician. He's speaking to the media. It's all very stage managed, all very crafted, and he's not really like getting real. Maybe that's a valid criticism point, but like when you're a world famous guy, you have to be like that. Look at what's happening to Elon Musk as he just starts running his mouth. It does a lot. He's causing a lot of problems for himself.
I enjoyed that personally.
And you can do it. And there's some method to the madness with him. But I mean, if you're like a superstar or you're a CEO of a company or you're a megachurch, you really, really, really have to craft carefully what you say. And it does come across, I think, inauthentic at some time, but you can't just extemporaneously make stuff up when people are actually treating you as their guru of life. You can really steer people wrong. So that's another reason I don't want to be the guru's guide to life. I give people tools. You can think about this. It's like, okay, Aaron, what's the best workout program? Whatever. I don't tell you that. I say, look, well, to me, the best workout program is the one you actually do. It's not, it's nothing to do about that. Some people do great on X, Y, or Z. Other people do great on A, B, or C. So I'm a little hesitant to do that. And that's one reason, I guess going back, that's one reason the focus on masculinity alone, I think, is tough, because what I don't want to do is write a whole bunch of things that are telling people techniques and tools to use, and here's what you need to be doing. And that is a lot of what those people are.
Just to chime in here for a second, because I love all these things you're saying. I am, first of all, until recently, I've been a great Nassim Taleb fan as well. His Anti-Fragile book absolutely had a huge impact on my life. The idea of skin in the game, I loved when I was looking at your website where you can subscribe to your newsletter. I love your guiding principles, Live Not by Lies. So clearly that book has had an impact on you. Build up, don't just tear down. Have skin in the game, provide serious, compelling insight people can't get anywhere else, and then pay it forward by helping younger or less prominent voices build an audience. I love your heart in all this. And as an entrepreneur, and Chris is an entrepreneur as well, I think, and Nassim Taleb talks about this, what's missing in our world is skin in the game. People don't have skin in the game. One of the things that brought you onto our radar was your Wall Street Journal article entitled What Jordan Peterson Can Teach Church Leaders. A lot of what you just said, I feel like, plays into that article. And also what we talk about here on our podcast about men rediscovering courageous leadership, because so many men, I think, are fearful of stepping out in ways and having skin in the game because they've had unfortunate repercussions as a result of it. So I'm curious, when you think of men today, what is holding us back from being courageous leaders like God has called us to be? What's holding us back? And I'm curious also how you see guys like Jordan Peterson, Andrew Tate, speaking to this issue in good and bad ways.
That's way too big a topic to fully cover here, but I'm very struck by a line from Peter Thiel's book, From Zero to One. He says, "Brilliant thinking is rare, but courage is an even shorter supply than genius." And that's basically true in our society. And I think it has to do with a lot of changes in the leadership structure of America. That's been one of the themes I've explored, looking at historical changes in leadership culture and the way things happen in the country. But I'll just tell you one little story. I moved out to the suburbs earlier this year. So I've lived here almost a year. And I start reading the local suburban paper, suburban websites. And several times I have read about a student at the local high school who has created some nonprofit initiative that they are pursuing. One was some high school students who started a nonprofit to help get middle school students interested in STEM careers. And far be it from me to be too cynical, but I'll channel my Gen X thing. But this is the reality today, is that if you want to get into a good college, which controls so much of your life, controls so much today in terms of opportunities that are presented to you, you have to go through this tedious resume building process in a way that my generation really didn't. You got to create your own bogus nonprofit. You can't have a job. It's not enough to just volunteer in the community. You have to actually create and lead your own nonprofit. And so you see a lot of people doing that and pitching it to the press so they can get press coverage for it. Or the new one that I keep hearing is publishing peer-reviewed research when you're in high school. There's apparently all these journals designed to get peer-reviewed research. If you go back to the 50s, a lot of it really was sort of who your daddy was. I hate to say it, but that sort of was it. If you were the child of the person who owned the local bank in town, you were the made man. And there's still some of that that's true. It's more money-oriented. But today, we've become much more credential-based, vastly more bureaucratic society. And so how do you succeed in society? You succeed in our society by tedious resume building, going to the right, doing all the AP classes, starting your fake nonprofit, getting perfect test scores, doing your little cultural thing. So one of the things I notice here, a lot of times people who are from immigrant backgrounds all engage in some cultural practice of their thing. There, I study a Hindu dance or some kind of Indian dance, or I'm doing this and that. And I might see these people are on the rocket ship to Harvard. Right? So we do that. Then we get to school and we check all the boxes. We get involved in all the right clubs and all the right causes. And we write our diversity statements. We know we have to have the exact impeccable views on DEI and climate change and all this, because if you don't, you're going to get knocked out. Even now, the CEOs of these companies, if they say something, look what's happened to Elon Musk, okay? You say one little thing out of line, and the activists, the board, and the Twitter mobs come after you. And so we have a generation of people who've, I think, become very cynical about the way to success is to check all the boxes. And yes, you work hard. There's no doubt you're working hard. These people are way, young people today are way more put together than I was. I would never be making it today. These people, they are buttoned down on everything. Hmm. But I think it's like the mentality is this is what it means to succeed, is to check all the boxes, color within the lines, all that stuff. And it's really just incredible, incredible cowardice that shows all of our leadership. I'm so disgusted by it. I can't handle it. And that's one problem. Big, big changes in the nature of society and the success roadmap and many other things. Much more credentialistic, much more bureaucratic, a lot of things like that. I think a second one is, now that we've done this, the only people who actually do go against the grain, by and large, they're sort of whack. They're provocateurs. They've said the other mechanism by which you become famous and make a living, if you don't want to check all these boxes and go through the tedious resume building process, is to become like an online influencer. And you do that by becoming a provocateur. Donald Trump is a provocateur. Andrew Tate is a provocateur. On down the line. So if you're like a normal person in a normal suburban community, and
with
your
any amount of nuance,
right? Your choice between the politicians and the CEOs who are very timid and fearful, and pastors, frankly, put them in there, and then the provocateurs who are very boorish and engage in all sorts of low class behaviors, you're obviously going to prefer that. And so, essentially, we've almost created a culture where to go against the grain, to display courage, I think for a lot of people is coded as act like a jerk, act very boorish. And actually, I think pre-pandemic Jordan Peterson, before he had his nervous breakdown and his problems, really was something of a model for what to be. Now, Peterson has become much more angry, much more political. He's not today what he was then. So he got famous for two things. There are really two things that made him famous. Number one was his statement that I will not comply with this Canadian pronoun law if they pass it, because that's compelled speech. And he sort of nuanced. He's like, look, I'm happy to call people what they want to be called, but if the government tells me I have to say these things, I'm not going to do it because that's compelled speech. It's against freedom. That was one. The second thing was this interview he did on the UK's Channel 4. You can still go to YouTube and just go Jordan Peterson Channel 4. You'll find it. Millions and millions and millions of views. It's like a 30-minute interview of him on UK network TV where this very hostile female kind of feminist presenter is grilling him essentially about being a misogynist in so many words. And he just calmly sits there. He doesn't back down. He holds his frame. He's not combative. He's very professional. He just keeps bringing it back to the peer-reviewed research and the empirical things that he knows well because he's a PhD in psychology and taught at Harvard and taught at the University of Toronto. And there's a lot about that as somebody who showed courage in a very difficult venue, but without acting like a provocateur. It was indeed very winsome, if you will. There's been a lot of debates in the evangelical world over the utility of winsomeness as a strategy. And a lot of it's part of that debate over Keller. Keller, he wanted to be winsome. And today we see that that's a road to compromise. And what we need to do is just be tough. Whereas I'm like, no, actually, you can be winsome. You can be normal. You can be polite and still be courageous and still stand firm and stand strong. And so if your guests have not watched the Jordan Peterson Channel 4 interview, I highly recommend it because it is really, to me, a model of public engagement And that's one of the reasons I keep coming back to him as an example, even though the Jordan Peterson of today is not the Jordan Peterson of 2018, because we have to find a way to demonstrate courage that does not involve acting like a jerk. And I think Musk, although he's certainly not the worst, he's just a provocateur. He does engage in that sort of provocateur approach, which is incented by social media. The way to get attention is to do controversial things. So all the incentive structures are to do that. But I think we need to fight against that and have people who both behave in a quote-unquote respectable manner and yet at the same time are in fact courageous in the public square, which is a tremendous lack of that today.
That to me sounds like meekness.
You don't hear me use a lot of terms like that because that's not a term that's in common use in American society today.
Sure. Right.
And that's the other thing I try not to. I think meekness, yeah, it's a biblical term and all that, but there's a lot of evangelical speak that people use to talk about it. I try to talk about things in plain, ordinary English and avoid evangelical world, because I don't think most people in America really have a good understanding of what meekness means. And you can get into a debate about what it means to be truly meek. And so I try to stick to words and phrases like normal people who aren't steeped in this culture can get and understand.
So what would be the dumbed down version of meekness then? That's probably a bad way of saying, because that makes people think, oh, if I don't understand meekness, I'm dumb. I didn't mean it that way.
I think it's like, no, that is one of the things, especially the evangelical world, people gravitate to that lingo. And that's one of the things that Keller did in New York when they started Redeemer. He's like, we're not using any pious babble, is what Kathy Keller called it. We're not using any of those words. We're going to use words that people in New York understand. I would say, if you look at Peterson, it's excellence, and that he really has his stuff cold. He has developed his potentialities and his knowledge. It is integrity. And I say this in the sense of structural integrity, like the hull of a ship or the fuselage of a plane. The pressures of this interviewer are bearing down on him, and he does not crack. He does not deform. He holds frame there. And I think a third one is maybe gravitas and seriousness. He treated what he was talking about as if it were deadly serious. And too often today, it's like everything is like a show, it's a game, it's show business. I think a fourth thing is mastery. You can think of mastery in two senses. One is mastery in the sense of what I called excellence earlier, mastery of his material, for example. The other point I would say is, though, it's mastery of himself. She's not getting under his skin. He's self-controlled. Mm-hmm. He's got self-control. He's got self-discipline. He's got self-mastery. And I think you put all those together, a lot of that comes into there, where you have this really excellent, knowledgeable guy who knows who he is, who can hold frame, have integrity, in the midst of the storm, be in control of himself, and have a seriousness and a gravitas about what he's doing, not getting drawn into petty conflicts. And is that Jordan Peterson today? I don't really follow him as much, but that was certainly him at his peak.
I think he's respectful, too. I think I've seen that interview, and I've seen another
one. Yeah, he is respectful.
I've seen another one where he's on stage with three other people, and they're much further to the left than he. And he's basically being attacked, almost ad hominem attacks, through most of this stage presentation. And he's very respectful. I think that was fairly recently, so I don't think he's lost. I don't think he's lost everything that he had.
I wouldn't say so either. I mean, I just think he signed on with the Daily Wire, which is a right-wing website. And if you read his Twitter feed, it's a very angry Twitter feed.
It's very angry.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
It's like angry haikus.
Right.
I think that's a good one. He does treat people with respect. He doesn't quite turn the other cheek, but he's like, I'm not going to just mirror what these other people are doing. He's self-controlled. He's like, they're saying all these things about me. I'm not going to respond in kind. I'm responding out of the values that I have. Not that he's not aware of the context. Again, not that he's letting them walk all over him. He's holding his ground. You can hold your ground. You can say this, but you can do it without this reactivity. I think this is one of the big things. You talk about men are strong. Men are driven. Men want to impose their will on the world. Men are this, that, and the other thing. But I think what we miss out a lot of the online discussion is men have self-control and self-mastery. And you don't see it. Twitter is like the land of no self-mastery.
Right.
And again, I don't claim to have gotten it completely right. But I don't need to comment on every single Twitter scandal of the day.
Right.
Stuff comes up, I just don't engage on it. That discipline is so lacking in so many people. They just cannot avoid the fray. I think getting involved too much in the fray every single day is not healthy for a lot of things. Yeah. But Peterson's like, I'm not going to let your things get under my skin. I'm in control of myself. You're not going to get me riled up and make me say and do something that I'm going to regret. And that's it. So I think that self-control, the sense of integrity, the sense of the storm is going around you, but you're right there. You're standing firm on the ground you're on. Not that you're not fighting back when people attack you, but what are you fighting back on? You're fighting back on the ideas. You're fighting with your goal. You're thinking about, what's the goal I want to achieve? To use the old Stephen Covey line, begin with the end in mind. What is the end I'm trying to achieve here? Now, for some people, their aim is a massive conflict that allows them to get millions of Twitter views and followers and build their audience. So their actual goal may not be convincing anybody of anything. It might be just generating more attention. Conflict brings attention. It's like two kids on the playground getting a fight. Everybody comes running. And that's why conflict is such a driver of social media. Everybody's in on the game. No, I'm going to fight with people. I'm going to get into it. And he's not afraid of conflict, but he's not just gratuitously acting crazy. And you got to think about, what is the objective I'm trying to achieve? The objective I'm trying to achieve is I want to equip essentially conservative American evangelical men, pastors and people, with the tools they need to understand the world and help build lives, ministries within it successfully. I'm not your one-stop shop. I'm hopefully only one of many voices you're listening to. You're getting a lot of different perspectives on the issue. I want people to take me seriously. And therefore, I want to act serious about what I'm doing. And so I feel like we do have to take it seriously. We do have to think about these things. Not all of that stuff is in the Wall Street Journal op-ed, but that's a big part of Peterson there.
Aaron, that was very helpful. I really appreciate that multifaceted definition. To me, when I think of meekness, which I know can be a biblical kind of evangelical term, is that power under control. They talk about that. Yeah. And I think in a different way, though, it was really helpful to define it by those other words you just described that I think will resonate more with folks. And
yeah.
That's the goal. That's what we want to be as men, right? We want to be a guy who has self-mastery, self-control, who's respectful, who has integrity and holds together under pressure and doesn't collapse, brings excellence and has a certain amount of gravitas and influence. Like, man, that describes the man I want to be. That's for sure.
Right. Now, of course, they say that essentially Jordan Peterson did collapse. He had a nervous breakdown. He had something happen, okay, which I don't judge him too much for. I mean, the amount of pressure that that guy was under, we cannot relate to what it is like to be in that kind of celebrity mode with that much pressure bearing down. And so that's why I say maybe it's a good thing if I don't get too big. I don't want to become a big celebrity because
yeah, right.
I don't know that I would handle being a celebrity well. I think I would like to have a much larger audience than I have now, to be clear. But I don't want to be a Jordan Peterson tier celebrity because I don't know that that would be healthy for me or that I would necessarily be able to do it.
But Aaron, you definitely go after some sensitive topics in your writings. I'm not saying you're trying to be confrontational, but you do have people who respond negatively to what you write, even though it's backed by research and you're trying to take an informed approach to what you're writing. How do you deal with people who attack you on Twitter or at least don't care for what you write when you put something
out
there?
Now, I have gotten in a few Twitter feuds, mostly over urban policy type stuff. And a lot of the Twitter mobs attack you over whatever. I mean, you never know what they're going to attack you over. Most of the topics I've been attacked over have not been quote unquote cancellation type things. You said something that could really get you in trouble in society. Because to be honest, I try to avoid doing that because I'm not interested in being a provocateur and getting out there to create all this attention. But I would say remarkably, I've gotten remarkably little hate. I have not gotten the hate mob. For whatever reason, people don't do to me what they do to other people. I think part of it is I tend to give a reasoned description of what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I think most of the people who disagree tend to disagree on some substantive point, which I think is completely fair for them to do. So I've had remarkably little of the vicious attacks of people that come after others. I think the other thing that helps me a little bit is I don't have a career, quote unquote, a career in evangelicalism. The evangelical world is sort of a collection of empires and fiefdoms and very hierarchical, and it's not really a healthy environment, to be quite honest. But if you want to get invited to the conferences, if you want to be put on the list or whatever, you better go along to get along. I think there's a huge amount to that, even in the evangelical world. Well, I don't aspire to be a part of your club. I'm not a pastor, and I'm not getting paid by a church. So because my career is not bound up with these people, I think I get less of the tremendous amount of back channel policing where they're told, you might want to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. You might want to stop saying that. I don't get very much of that. On the other hand, to be quite honest, I'm more disciplined in what I say than some of those other guys. There's a psychologist named John Gottman. He's kind of famous in the world of divorce. Yeah. And I don't know all that much about him, but he's got this rule. He was the guy who claimed he could tell if a couple was going to get divorced with 90% accuracy simply by watching them interact for 15 minutes. Wow. And his conclusion was, it's not about communication styles, or it's not about this or any of that stuff. He's like, the rule of thumb was you have to have 5 times more positive than negative interactions. If you hit that ratio of 5 times positive to 1 negative or better, then you're going to stay together. If it gets worse than that, you're not. Now, maybe oversimplifying his approach, and it's like a lot of things of that nature, psychology, it's probably bunk at some level. But I think it illustrates a principle, which is if you want to say something negative about someone, or if you want to critique somebody's work or whatever, it helps to say a lot of nice things about them too. And so if I talk about one of these pastors, I try to think about how can I be maximally fair? How can I sort of preamble this with all the good things? My old boss used to do that. He'd say, Aaron, you're one of the smartest guys I know. And whenever this guy started telling you how smart you were, you knew you were in trouble. It's like, Aaron, you're one of the smartest guys I know. You're way too smart to be effing up so bad. And keep working hard. It's sort of like that.
It's a sandwich approach.
He sandwiches that and he sticks the knife in. So that's one of those techniques you can use. But there are people that I do criticize. I am pretty critical of that. I don't necessarily do that for. But I try to think about how do you affirm, even if you're criticizing a position that someone took, how can you affirm the person and the value that they've had and many things like that, and avoid this very Manichaean view of the forces of light versus the forces of darkness, and here are the good guys and here are the bad guys, because the real world's way more complex than that. Not that there aren't these issues where there's sort of a binary outcome on something. I'm not saying that you shouldn't fight. I think that has led a lot of people to neglecting the legitimate serious problems on their own side. And then you also tend to excessively demonize the other people. So that's what I try to do. I try to massage it a little bit, and I try to make it as much about the substantive point more than the person who's making it. Here's why the idea is wrong. Here's not why the person is an idiot, or the person is this, or the person is that.
And that's not normal. Right, not in today's world. That is not the status quo.
No, I'm not saying, I'm not telling you, I've got it right. But these are the considerations to have. There's so many things I could tell you. And this is what I say. When I say build up, not just tear down, this is an example of the kind of considerations I like to give people. I do have a lot to say on the men's topic. A lot of it is news you can use, much like the online gurus, but it's less directive. You must do X. You should do X. Here's the path to success. Now, what I'm saying is, here are some considerations. And when you interact, here's the sorts of things that you could and should be thinking about. But ultimately, you have to make the decision, because the consequences of what you say and do are going to fall on you. They're not going to fall on me, most likely.
Amen. You've got to do your own work. You got to get skin in the game. I think we want it easier. We want someone to spoon feed us what we need to do often, or what we should do. And it's not that easy. You've got to do your own work, make your own mistakes, fail. Yeah.
The one thing I will tell you to do is you got to subscribe to my newsletter at aaronrenner.com.
It's funny you said that.
You got to subscribe to my newsletter and you have to buy my book, Life in the Negative World. Those two things you 100% should do.
Fantastic. I was literally going to say, Aaron, as we wrapped up, I just subscribed to your newsletter.
Oh, good.
And I would encourage everybody else to do the same. If you're listening, for sure, check it out. Because I think this approach that you're taking is sorely needed in our world and what's left of Christendom, whatever little pieces are still there. I think we need it. We need that desperately. So thank you so much for your approach. Thank you so much for your time today with us. I want to be able to pray for you here before
we let you
go, though. So yeah, let me pray. Heavenly Father, God, you are so good. Thank you, God, for this time together. Thank you for the lessons that you've brought forth through Aaron. Thank you, God, for the fact that we have a hope in you. We have such confidence that we can have in you, Lord, that should cause us not to be insecure and operate out of fearfulness, but out of courage. Lord, you are the one through your Holy Spirit that provides the ultimate integrity we need for eternal salvation because of your Son, Jesus. And Lord, I pray that you help all of us to lean into that. And as we interact with others who believe differently from us, God, help us to be respectful and to be self-controlled and to be full of integrity, God. Lord, thank you for Aaron, for his ministry, and all that he's doing, God. Continue to provide and protect he and his family, God. I know he's not getting attacked too much, but often it does happen, and sometimes it's more spiritual than otherwise, Lord. So just pray for your protection over him and that you'd continue to draw him close to your side, Lord, as he does the work that you're calling him to, God. So we entrust him into your hands now in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Aaron.